All right, so at first I was thinking of doing more of an overview, but then I decided I don't like overviews. I'm going to be presenting work that's primarily, well, it's going to be the work of two PhD students working between my lab and Susan Makucha's lab in the Department of Plant Breeding at Cornell, Joshua Cobb. And Josh is here in the audience. He's here at the meetings, getting an award from the International Plant Research Institute, a graduate student award, and Randy Clark. So, you know, my lab studies mineral nutrition, mineral ion transport, plant responses to the environment, and sometimes I say, Leon, you're kind of the master of the obvious, you know, in terms of the title of this slide. You know, in terms of increasing the mineral nutrient density of food crops and the edible parts, the seeds and the fruits, obviously you're going to be talking about a very complex interplay of lots of different transport processes, expression of genes and proteins, regulatory networks to get those metals from the soil up into the shoot and then on into the seed, at least for a cereal grain. So you're talking about processes at the subcellular, cellular, organ, and whole plant level. That's pretty obvious to this audience. And this is my one slide in terms of an overview of this complexity of this process. This is a cartoon of the root-soil interface, one of the key sites, obviously, acquisition of the nutrients into the root symplasm, starting in the epidermis and outer cortex. And then those ions, those mineral ions, would move radially through the root to the xylem. This is another key step, unloading of the metals and mineral nutrients into the xylem stream, where they're moved via transpirational pull up into the leaf. Now things go in the other way into maturing and mature leaves. But then to get them up into a grain or a reproductive structure, you need to then reload from your source leaves into the phloem, another membrane-embounded organ, and long-distance pressure-driven flow now, as opposed to tensional-driven flow in the xylem, into the grain. So lots of different places, lots of different transporters. There's been some progress on these. But I decided, in thinking about this, I'm not going to talk about transport per se. I'm going to talk more about, you know, what's been happening in terms of advances in genetic approaches and integrating them in with the physiological or phenotyping approaches, where again we're having advances in a couple of examples. So I'm going to start off, you know, I'm far from a geneticist, just talk a little bit about both traditional and association mapping in terms of the mapping approaches. We're doing this work in the Rice Association panel, and Shannon, who's been working with us for a lot more years, will be talking more about it. The two traits we're phenotyping, and this is Josh's work on ionomics of the root and shoot, and I believe from Shannon we'll hear about ionomics in the grain, and so all three of these things are nice complementary approaches. And then the new area we're focusing on is root system architecture and a very complex set of traits and how to start dissecting those, ultimately to get at the genes and then to use that information for crop improvement. And so here we go with my couple of slides on introduction to genetics. So when we're talking about genetic mapping, we're really, you know, talking about statistical associations, correlations between markers, which would be variations in the alleles of different versions of a particular gene at a locus, and a phenotype. So correlation between, you know, genetic markers and your phenotype. And, you know, one assumption you have to make is that if you do have one of these correlations, then this must be in linkage disequilibrium with a gene that underlies the trait. And I'll get back to LD or linkage disequilibrium in a moment. It's how do you make sure you have markers that are in linkage disequilibrium with the relevant genes, because that's ultimately what we'd like to get at. So the two types of mapping we're doing, well, the more traditional biparental mapping, you start off with two inbred parents. You make a hemizygous parent where at each locus are carrying one copy from each parent. Of course, in the F2, they start segregating, so then you're going to start having, you know, jumbling up of the alleles from each parent. You can do a bunch of intermating to jumble this up even more to increase the resolution. And then you start doing single seed descent to fix these, to make them homozygous at each allele. And then you have an immortal population that you can study for your phenotyping. And that's what a lot of us use. And then on the other side, association mapping, where we're actually putting together a diversity panel, capturing the diversity that's there. So here your jumbling of the genome has gone on through, you know, thousands of generations of crossing and recombination. So you might get lots or thousands or millions of sequence differences between individual lines in your panel. And the key here is to sort out which of those sequence differences are important for your differences in your particular phenotype. So really, association mapping is a form of QTL mapping that takes advantage of the linkage disequilibrium that would be in your diversity panel to correlate or associate differences in phenotype with differences in genotype. So I've been mentioning linkage disequilibrium. So you would have occurrences along a particular stretch of the genome of your plant, you know, different combinations of markers indicating different combinations of alleles that would occur either more frequently or less frequently than would be predicted purely by random chance based on the allele frequencies in the parents. And so you get these haplotypes, which is really just kind of a combination of these different alleles that along a stretch of genome that are transmitted together, they're linked together. Okay, so then association mapping, really this correlation between haplotypes and differences in your trait, the phenotype, is based on the idea that the traits that have entered the population, your population fairly recently, will still be linked to the genetic sequence of the original ancestors, and that the trait will be often be more found within a specific haplotype. And so it really asks if a particular marker or set of markers is more common in a particular phenotype and possibly are causative for that. So in what we do here in association mapping, both we're doing this through collaboration with Susan McCooch, who's been doing all of the genetics, but also on the sorghum side, we ourselves, which I'm not going to talk about today, have assembled and characterized our own association panels. So you assemble a diversity panel that captures a lot of the diversity for your species of choice worldwide. The panel is genotyped for a large number of single nucleotide polymorphisms across the genome, and that's an area where things have been moving forward very rapidly in terms of new and cheaper and broader high-throughput technologies. And also you need to phenotype each member of that panel for your trait. Then you use fairly sophisticated statistics to quantify the correlations between differences in your DNA sequence and differences in your phenotype. And so the mapping then identifies DNA sequences that are possibly responsible for that phenotype. You have to correct for false positives because you're going to have associations that are false positives that occur because some members in your panel are related, so you have to correct for this population structure, and that's part of the sophisticated statistics. And there's two types of association mapping. There's candidate gene where you can test, can this candidate gene be important for a trait? Or there's genome-wide strategies, which is what we're doing in Shannon, and we're all doing in Rice. Oops, let me go back one. So genome-wide association is useful in species like rice and sorghum, where you have elevated levels of linkage disequilibrium. You have larger regions of the genome that are fixed or moved together during recombination, compared to like Arabidopsis and maize, which have much smaller, lower degrees of LD. And so because you have these blocks like in rice, the genome-wide association approaches allow you via genotyping and phenotyping your diversity panel to scan the entire, say, rice genome for QTL for your trait and identify many alleles for those QTL. So it allows you to search blindly genomic regions, novel genomic regions. We've used this very successfully in rice aluminum tolerance, a trait that I know a lot about, and we've identified novel QTL. We've actually moved and cloned a couple of the genes underlying those. We've also identified candidate genes that others thought may be involved in tolerance, but for which there was no diversity. And then finally, my last slide on the association mapping. This genome-wide association takes advantage of recombination events that have accumulated over thousands of generations, so you can get a pretty high resolution for mapping your QTL compared to traditional QTL mapping and recombinant inbred lines. And because it's a blind approach, you can identify new regions continue, you know, where you don't know what the candidate genes are. And in rice with a sequenced genome, you then can use other approaches to narrow that down and look for candidate genes. So the rice diversity panel that we use from Susan Makucha's NSF Transgressive Variation Project, there's 500 accessions collected from all the major rice domestication regions around the world. Rice, when you look at the genetics, it's very subpopulation specific. There's five major subpopulations, very deep divisions in between each of these genetically. And Susan has developed a 44,000 SNP affymetrix chip that the panel has been genotyped for. And now, just now, her 1 million SNP chip is coming out, and it'll be re-genotyped with 1 million SNPs. And of course, she, like a lot of us, she's also doing genotyping by sequencing to add even more markers. And so this panel consists of 400 domesticated rice accessions and also 100 wild rice Oryza rufa pogon accessions. So again, we're trying to capture some novel traits from wild progenitors of domesticated rice. And so what we're doing for the phenotyping that I'm going to start talking about, the ionomics and root system architecture, is we're doing really both linkage and association mapping. So we're phenotyping the rice association panel and also a widely used recombinant inbred line panel for biparental mapping between IR64 and indica rice and Azucena tropical japonica for these mineral nutrition traits. So in these two approaches, the association and biparental mapping can be complementary. The association mapping allows us to mine a much wider and deeper pool of alleles and a broader range of QTL. The biparental mapping allows us, we found this in the aluminum tolerance, to identify some rare alleles that get lost in the genome-wide association. They get cut off, so you don't find them in GWA approaches. Okay, so now into the phenotyping. First, going to talk about the ionomics. Here's a picture of Josh sitting right there with two of his four sons, so you can say he's already been a very productive graduate student. And ionomics really was a field, I'd say it was started by a good friend of mine, David Salt, you know, found, hey, the joys of ICP emission and mass specs, and really to look at the complete set of mineral nutrients and associated metals in the plant and look at them, you know, through high throughput and analyze them simultaneously in terms of accumulation and then using statistics and genetics to cull out information about that. And as I said, this has been driven by ICP emission, you know, inductively coupled plasma emission and mass spectrometers, which allow you to measure simultaneously some 25 to 30 and even more now elements, most of the essential mineral elements except for nitrogen, and also a number of other ones we're interested that are potentially toxic, because part of biofortification in our lab is to keep the nasty metals out, particularly arsenic and cadmium, out of rice grain. We've been fortunate to have really, when I came to the ARS lab at Cornell in 1985, we had one of the first ICPs. We've always been ahead of the curve there. We have a scientist, Mike Rutsky, who runs this facility and also now runs Cornell's facility, and he's really a pioneer in improving. So he really knows how to get the most out of these machines, and he and Josh have really optimized both the ICP. Josh has optimized the growth, the nutrient media, where we provide all of the essential nutrients in a kind of appropriate level, plus subtoxic levels of other metals that we're interested in, like cadmium, like arsenic, like lead, and then beneficial metals like selenium and silicon. So they've done a lot of work, and I can't show all that, to really get really clean and high resolution part per billion detection limit, precise and accurate data. So here's in our walk-in growth chamber, Josh growing the rice lines hydroponically. And what's the volume of these tubs? How many?
100 liters.
Yeah, 100 liters. And so he's done four replicates of the 400 lines representing the domestic rice in the association panel, three replicates of the 77 wild rice, and two replicates of 150 of the rills from the biparental mapping population. So lots of data. And then he's analyzing three tissues, the entire root, the entire shoot, and then calculating. So there's three phenotypes, root, mineral concentrations, shoot, and then root-shoot ratio. And then David Salt has now moved to the University of Aberdeen and has collaborators at the ARS labs in Beaumont and Stuttgart are looking at grain concentration. So what we're doing is complementary. The three data sets should be very useful for, I mean, it's going to be a resource for mining information about mineral nutrition and biofortification for years to come. So Josh tells me we have finished all of the phenotyping. We had finished first the biparental mapping population, and he told me just now, finally, they finished all of the association mapping phenotyping. So now the GWAS analysis will start for the association panel. This is just a genetic map for the biparental mapping population, and you know, it's marked just with 220 SSR markers, but it's being re-genotyped using genotyping by sequencing, so we should be able to get another 10 to, or 1,000 or more markers on this, which will open up other types of QTL analysis. The phenotypes of interest are root shoot and root shoot ratio of concentrations of all of these elements, all of the essential mineral elements except nitrogen, plus things like aluminum, cadmium, lead, silicon, selenium, arsenic, things that we're interested in terms of keeping some of those out of the grain. So now he's done, Josh has done composite interval mapping of the real population, and he'll be doing some more sophisticated QTL mapping later. Just showing you a little bit, because we're right in the middle of this snapshot. We're getting lots of phenotypic variation and transgressive segregation. Here you see root arsenic concentrations, the concentrations in arsenic and the roots of the parents. So you see big variation and big transgressive variation. Another example here for magnesium. And another one for shoot cadmium, which often can be that. Shoot concentrations and grain concentrations aren't always proxy for each other. Sometimes they can be. In many cases, you got to get the metal into the shoot to get it then redirected from the source leaves into the grain, but you have to be careful there. But I think for cadmium, that is the case. And then finally, this is simply a summary of the QTL mapping from the initial preliminary QTL mapping from the real population superimposed on the 12 rice chromosomes. Got a lot of QTL for different elements, accumulation in roots, shoots, root shoot ratio. Red means QTL explained between above 15%. I think our biggest ones are for around 20% for magnesium and lead. Yellow is between 10 and 15%, and even the lowest ones, blue, are about 8%. So there's lots of QTL. I'm not going to make a big deal about this yet. There's a lot to be done yet to overlay this with the GWAS data that we'll be getting. And then what are we going to do with that? I'll talk about that a bit at the end of the talk, because the same thing applies to the second phenotype we're looking at, which is genome-wide analysis of root system architecture. So there's a growing awareness that's been happening over the last 10, 15 years, work by people like Jonathan Lynch, who's a pioneer, that the spatial distribution of roots and soil in three dimensions, which is what we call root system architecture, plays an important role in mineral nutrient acquisition and water acquisition of a lot of poorly available, sparingly available nutrients. So the plants really need to place those roots carefully in the best places in the soil profile. And certainly there's a big environmental component, but there's certainly a lot of genetic control over these traits that we're trying to go after to get the genes underlying them. And really, I think there's a good example from work from a close colleague of ours, Hong Liao, who directs the Root Biology Center at South China Agricultural University in Guangzhou, China. They work with soybean on acid soils. The largest expanse of acid soils in the world is southern China. And in these soils, you tend to have subsoil acidity increasing in proton concentration. So aluminum toxicity increases this way. Low phosphorus and phosphorus fixation is the other problem on these acid soils. And what phosphorus you have is tied up in the surface soil. So they said, you know, maybe phosphorus-efficient roots that can tolerate this low phosphorus have lots of shallow roots that go after what phosphorus is there. And sure enough, they found that the phosphorus-efficient soybean lines had this type of a root architecture with a few deep roots for water. So they actually have done root breeding, have bred this trait into their local varieties, have now released new soybean varieties, better adapted to these soils that are giving very significant increases in yield based on this root architecture. A beautiful example of this. So Jonathan Lynch has been modeling this, and this would be a predictive model for low P to these shallow roots when there's sufficient water. But if you have sufficient P and low water, you're going to want generally deeper roots. So there's a trade-off. And what if you have low P and low water? Then you would probably have to get something with some shallow roots and some deep roots. So, and the plant only has so much carbon it can invest in roots. So this is a strategy that gets complicated. Okay, so the work that we're doing in our lab, Randy Clark is a PhD student. He's in biological engineering, so he knows a lot about plant biology and also computers and computational analysis and image analysis. So I'm just going to talk about his work on root system architecture in three dimensions, work that we published in June in Plant Physiology on the cover. So he grows them, and we know this is a very artificial environment of a semi-sterile gel end gum with all of the nutrients. We grow rice in this. We have been looking carefully to make sure they are not oxygen limited, and they're not. They grow well in this system. They're grown on an automated turntable that's controlled by a computer, which also controls a digital camera. So what we do is to take an image, a 2D image of the root system, shown here, rotates 90 degrees, takes another image, so you rotate it 40 times through 360 degrees, all automated, and you get these 40 images of this root system, 2D images. And then he's written this Root Reader 3D software, which, by the way, is available on my lab website. And this will take these 2D images and reconstruct them for each plant into a 3D root system architecture. And then we then quantify automatically a number of root traits where we're guessing, and based on other work, things that might be important for mineral nutrient acquisition, particularly of diffusion-limited nutrients. This is all automated. You can there's a user interface where you can focus on specific root types, which is another thing. When you look at rice, there's a range of different roots in terms of crown roots, primary roots, lateral roots. We can quantify growth in different aspects of the individual or different root types. Then I have a movie here where he's also written algorithms to kind of help clarify things. So here's his 3D root reconstruction, and as you'll see here in a second, so he can mathematically remove the crown roots, which are obscuring the roots underneath it, and so we can quantify these mathematically without destructively sampling any root system. Okay, get on to the next slide. So coming down the home stretch, we have completed the phenotyping of the rice association panel, all 500 lines plus 168 lines of that biparental mapping population. This is done by Randy Clark, and then also Janelle Jung, who's a PhD student in Susan's lab, who works in my lab, and she's focusing on the wild rice aspects. So this involved phenotyping 2,000 individual plants in these cylinders. We can do about 90 in each experiment. We get dynamic root growth images, because we image over 3, 6, 9, and 12 days. So this has all been completed. The phenotyping has been completed, the quantification of the 3D root structure, the 20 traits, and so now we'll be moving on, as with Joss's, to the GWAS analysis, first with the 44K and the 950K SNP chips. As I pointed out, we follow root growth over time, so you can get growth of individual types of roots, and we're looking to automate this and collect data over shorter time periods. We can get time-lapse imaging movies of the roots, because you can see it's very dynamic the way the roots grow when you start looking at this. And I said, we've got all these traits. Some of these are kind of a guess, and we can always add more. Some of your more traditional root traits, such as root length of different types, root tips, root thickness, etc. But some are more complex descriptors of root system architecture, like centroid, the vertical position of the center of mass of the whole root system, volume distribution, the ratio of volume of the root system in the top one-third divided by the root volume system in the bottom two-third, which this is really a measure of how well they grow out, shallowly versus deep, which is, we have bushiness, which is another measure of the complexity of the branch, and there's all sorts of things, and we created these traits, so we're going to have to find out which ones are important, which ones generate big QTL, and whether they're significant. Last couple slides, just a little bit of data from Randy's, and this just shows correlations of each of the 20 traits with each other. For all, you know, so each of these is 400 data points for the association panel. Some correlate nicely, some don't, and we're doing some more sophisticated analysis to see, you know, what's the significance of this. And here you can see some of these traits where the frequency distribution, and some of them, like total root system volume, is fairly normal and with centroid, but some are show no normal distribution. Some are skewed to the left, skewed to the right. And then we have some root system traits that don't seem to be much different in the different subpopulations, and then some like volume distribution, and I can't read the other one, which we get significant variation both within and between the different subpops. So last slide. Where are we going with all this ionomic and root system architecture data? Well, we have a lot of approaches to put together to try to get at the genes. We want to know the physiological relevance, relate these to actually, do they have some role in important mineral nutrition and biofortification traits? And we have to move from the gel to more real world, which we have a number of ways that we can do this, I think, effectively. And it'll be really interesting to take Josh's data, interlay it with Randy's data, root system architecture with mineral nutrition. And then I certainly want to thank the funding, particularly my agency, for the funding for this work. Thanks.